And when you're ready, you just raise your hand and he'll come pick up the little paper and the pen.
Here's we have some questions.
Yeah. Well, here's somebody that left already, so but they thought it out before we started.
Okay.
The Saturday morning class, I shared the slide. When we feel loving shelter and protection in our relationship with Guru and Krishna, qualities such as tolerance and respect for others without expecting anything in return will develop. Can you elaborate? How does this feeling or sense of feeling sheltered and protected deepen or is cultivated in one's relationship with other Vaishnavas? So how does this feeling or sense of feeling sheltered and protected deepen or cultivate in our relationship with other Vaishnavas? Well, very simply, this is somebody that's not with us right now asking a question. connecting to one of the core messages that I was sharing is something that we all share as Krishna's in our heart. Same Krishna is in our heart. And each spirit soul is unique and individual, but each spirit soul is part of that supreme soul. So if we're connecting or feeling sheltered by Krishna and the representatives of Krishna, the guru or gurus, then we'll feel those feelings. And feeling those feelings, other Vaishnavas, they're also carrying Krishna in their heart, and they're part and parcel of Krishna. So it's just, the circle expands. There's the center, and then concentric circles around the center. So if the center of that concentric circle is on target, if we're feeling sheltered, but by our in our relationship with Krishna and the spiritual master, the concentric circles go out. It deepens the relationships and the sense of connection with others. Like Prabhupada expresses it in the Ishapanishad as universal brotherhood, and people use that term loosely or conventionally, and it doesn't really mean anything without the center. And when the center is clear, then it's very meaningful, because brotherhood is we have common father. But if that center is missing, that sense of connection with others like us or unlike us is missing. So the individual is not here to say something further, so we'll carry on. You read the question. And
okay. Yeah. I'm a little cold today, so you have to excuse me.
Okay.
You probably won't see it. Won't
Don't say cough this way, cough that way.
So, problem is quicker than you. So, here's the question. During the seminar, I learned about empathic communication between the panelists and the children. They are the charters, could you please elaborate how to train a child to have empathic and respectful communication with each other, during a conflict between them? Okay. So, the first point I have, or problem I have, is with the word train. Usually, to me, the implicit meaning of training is like training a dog or a train. You know, a pet dog, training not to pass school and house or something like that. So, I would say to facilitate a child in having empathy and understanding, respectful communication. So even the word respectful, I have no problems with. I would say facilitate a child in understanding the process of empathy. Well, it's the same as when you're dealing with an adult, except it may take a little bit more time, that you would, depending on how old the child is, of course. First of all, it would be good to emphasize or be empathic with the child's needs. And perhaps go over the whole need chart that we have here on the wall. And say, when you said that to little Billy, or little Doss, whatever you said, you know, I hate you guts, or something like this, because child said to each other. Then, what were you feeling when you were younger? And what need did you have at that particular point? Because we all have needs. And the child would obviously, or hopefully, respond and say, you know, I have a need for fairness. Because that's basically it. And then emphasize with the empathic, with the child's need for fairness, and then ask the child how the other child felt at that particular point. How would you feel if someone said what you said to him? And then the child would say, I feel really horrible. Because, you know, I have the need for respect. So put yourself in the other child's position. This is sort of a role play. We wouldn't do role play with children in this particular case. But ask the child how he would feel, and then the child would pretty much, in most cases, understand how he would feel in the same situation. And that may take a number of cases, dealing with the child in a number of cases, to try to facilitate a child in understanding empathic communication. That's how I would do it.
Here's some more.
Oh, some more.
Yeah, well, but you're getting, we'll go back and forth. What's, is this one on your...
Oh, you want to answer the same one?
No. Hang on. No. Okay, this is yours. This is the needs question.
Okay. So, should I give you the ones that don't have any...
No. I gave you all the on your topic, and I have the ones that are the off-topic ones. Let me do the off-topic one next. How to help children do austerity. Skip some meals. No. Or a little hard work. By considering long-term benefit. We'll send them to school. That's Prabhupada's classic. Is okay, you're 5 years old. Off to school. I want to play. No, you got to think long term. You got to go to school. Someday you're going to grow up and you're going to have to be smart. Work like a donkey and have a job and do it smart. So, got to go to school. So, a best way to teach children anything is model it. And then, when you model it, you can help them understand what you're doing and why. It's some inconvenience or austerity or whatever it is, but there's a why. You know, it's that, say, mom's in the kitchen and it's hot, and so it's not like you want to brag to the kid that I'm doing stuff for you, so you should feel gratitude, right, kid? Not like that, but it's passing on a quality. And so by modeling it, then explaining it, and just like Maharaj said, you know, a number of times, it's by example. And then by precept, it illustrates the example. And then doing that yourself. It's cold out or it's hot out. You do something anyways. So you tolerate the inconvenience because there's a higher purpose. And explain it. Model it and explain it. Achar and Prachar. It can take a while.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, here's another one. Hare Krishna. I am able to recognize my needs. Congratulations. However, at times I feel guilty or embarrassed about having them. Is it okay to separate who I am from my needs? Or do I need to accept that those needs are intrinsic to my being? So the first thing that we need to understand as far as needs is that needs are not focused on a particular individual or circumstance fulfilling that particular need. Usually guilt will arise when we focus on fulfilling our needs with a particular individual. That I have a need for you to cook for me. When you see a marriage relationship or something like that. Or I have a need for a child for you to behave. I have a need for people to work with me. You know, all these things are focused on others. And one of these things are demands. They're not needs. Because if you use the need language for a demand, it's still a demand. It's not the language, it's the intention behind the language. For example, I can make a request and make it into a demand. Would you be willing to cook for me? That's the demand. You know, it's the tone of voice. As we mentioned before, there's the tone of voice, the body language, which is more important than the actual words. So you have to examine what is your intention when you think about your needs. That may be one reason why you're feeling guilty about having needs. Another reason is that maybe you join the Hare Krishna movement. And you were told by some, like, I had that experience actually, sorry about that. It's not having to do with Maharaj here. I was told by another sannyasi that I was a brahmachari.
He's got a cold, he's alright.
When I was young, a young brahmachari around this turn of the 18th century. I was told that you don't have any, the only need you have is to be Krishna conscious. So this was drilled into my mind. You don't need to reveal your mind. You don't need love. You know, especially if you're going to be a sannyasi or brahmachari, you don't need love. Because people equate love with, you know, man, woman, type of relationship, of course, nowadays.
That's not quite
right. Nowadays, people just think, sorry, no.
Don't go there.
I have to go there. I had an appointment at Duke University that had to fill out my particular proclivities. Are you this? I won't go over the details. So we're taught sometimes in religious society, or in what we call a domination culture. You've read my book, you know what I'm talking about. A domination culture is basically a culture, a very authoritative, hierarchical culture in which people's needs are denied. Like a child is told, you have to study this, become a doctor. I don't really want to be that. For example, I had one of my disciples was forced to become a doctor. They actually went to medical school, got certified as a doctor, and finally when they got certified, they told the parents, I'm not going to work as a doctor. I did this to you, but now I'm going to do what I actually want to be, a software engineer. Why don't you want that? So In any case, so depending on the culture, it's not only the Irish services and some people services and religious societies. Religious societies tend to be, as I did mention in the book, to facilitate people being less empathic with themselves and with others because of the judgmental language. So that may be the reason. So what you need or need to do, what is a good strategy, is to associate with those who are aware of their needs and help you understand that those needs are part of your psychological, psychophysical makeup right now. In your particular situation, your particular stage of progress in devotional service, and be aware of it, and you can reveal your mind to someone else in confidence without the pressure you're not going to do or not yet to prove to you. Don't tell everybody in the world about your needs. Don't go on the internet, don't go on Facebook and tell everybody about your needs. But reveal and to someone who is mature enough to help you understand that these are your actual needs, to facilitate you understanding your actual needs. These needs are not intrinsic to your being, but they're intrinsic to your present psychophysical condition. And as your father said, one of the duties of the spiritual master is to engage the devotee according to their psychophysical condition at that particular time. And that, of course, refers a lot to our action. Okay.
We've got a lot of questions and not a lot of time.
I'm sorry.
You have to be like sure. So, I would like to know whether my understanding is right. Didn't give the option. In Krishna consciousness, we are trying to help the soul go back to Godhead. So, it will be the same for both Western or Indian. This is in reference to more stress of Western outreach in Krishna consciousness. Well, yes, it's the same, and there's more stress on Western outreach in part because there's an imbalance presently. It's not this is better and that's less important. The emphasis is because the other one is de-emphasized, so it's just making a balance. And there are some places I know where they want it to be really clear. Both are important. We have strategies for both important ones, and they are both important. We should have strategies for everybody. So that's that one. I was in Virginia, and as we were driving to go to a home program, I noticed all the families were Indian. So I asked, I said, what's the percentage of Indian families in this neighborhood? He said 90%. And he said the 10% are Chinese, right? I said, yeah, how'd you know? And I said, it's because it's good school district, right? He said, yeah. I said, it's really high taxes, right? He said, yeah. How did you know? Because there's so many Indians here. Now, strategy is we do door-to-door in that community, and we have some Bhakti Vriksha gatherings, and some people will come. And that's important. It's important. And then the other is also important. There have to be strategies for both. Hare Krishna.
My understanding is that as a parent, I can have needs for my child at home too. For instance, I can tell my child I have a need to facilitate your health, and therefore, please, go to bed. Is my understanding correct? It depends on how you communicate with it. And yes, the same answer, that body language and tone of voice. You can say, I would need you to go to bed. Will you please go to bed already? Or you could say, that I have an need for your welfare, I'm very concerned. You should take more time to explain it to the child. And, you know, I love you very much. You express your unconditional love for the child. And I'm concerned. Would you be willing to go to bed? And then you could also explain what are the intrinsic ramifications of him going to bed on time and intrinsic responses to him saying that. The intrinsic ramifications of not going to bed, for example, when we're done, that if you go to bed late, you're going to be too tired in the morning when you get up. And you're not going to have time to do the things you like to do in the morning. So, intrinsic ramifications are good as far as motivational practice.
There you go. It's on topic. So here's another off-topic question. Please describe marginal energy. How do I explain Radha-Krishna relationship to a non-devotee? I preambled it. Anything under the sun, on topic, off topic, up, down, sideways, anywhere you like. So we're getting some. Marginal energy means really simple. In between spiritual material. So the classic example is where the river meets the river bank. Over on this side is the river, over on that side is the river bank, and the marginal is, it's neither river nor river bank, it's touching both. So that's the marginal energy. We, the tiny living entity, are spiritual, para prakriti, but we're also prakriti. We're spiritual potency, but we're not para-Brahman. We're tiny. We're Brahman. So that's marginal. That's the living entity. So explain it is depending upon where our attention goes, where our free will choices go, we can be in the internal potency or the external potency. That's a free will decision. Kind of. Meaning, kind of means, it's not just, okay, I don't like it over here anymore, I'm going over there. It's not that simple. We'll do the Radha-Krishna relationship after this next one.
Okay, Hare Krishna, respected Maharajas, Dhanabhat Pranam, I understand that I'm responsible for fulfilling my needs. How does it work between husband and wife? What is the transactional element between the two? I use transactional element for lack of a better word. If love is transactional element, it sounds vague. What is the give and take, love and trust that happens in relationships? Well, as I mentioned in the seminar, when people get married, they generally think that the other person is going to fulfill all their needs. So there needs to be a particular stage in the relationship where you talk about each other's needs, and you come up with strategies that are conducive to the relationship. For example, just give one example. Let's say a man has a need for recreational activities, and he really likes to play volleyball or something. And the woman doesn't like to play volleyball, and her need for recreational activities is cooking her own shabbos. That's very good. And so the man will, instead of demanding that his wife play volleyball with him, he'll
roll shabbos.
He'll go with his friends and play volleyball with his friends. So that's a male thing, it's not a female thing. And he'll fulfill that particular need for recreation, not with his wife, but with someone else. And his wife will fulfill her particular need for recreation over the place with her friends. As simple as that. Look for other strategies. Don't demand that that person has to be the person to fulfill each and every need. And be honest with each other. Your man and woman in a married relationship have to have other outside, you know, within the purview of that relationship, with other outside means and strategies to fulfill their needs. And that keeps the relationship strong and understood.
Okay. Well, here's a... I don't know who wanted to know this question, but or the answer. How to explain the Radha-Krishna relationship to a non-devotee? Generally, I wouldn't try to. But it depends on the non-devotee. You know, if it's a Western non-devotee and they really want to know, then, you know, the Western mindset is God is neither man nor woman. We said God is both man and woman. Huh. Radha-Krishna. One entity, female, male, the relationship is energy, energetic. And that's, God is both male and female. So what then, if you say both male and female, why do you say he? He sees Adha Damodaraki. Then why do you say he? Well, we refer to the energetic, but he implies she, because where's the sun without the sunshine? You know, if they're just argumentative, they'll just argue and you won't go anywhere. But if they, you know, they'd like to understand what your understanding is, then that's something you might do with a Western person, Western-oriented person. And, you know, there's Indian people who aren't devotees, and they have a different background, different cultural picture of things, and you would explain it differently. You know, so without saying how you would, well, they want to know how you would explain it to them. There's a source of everything. And according to Bhagavad Gita and many other sources, that source of everything is Krishna. And there's a relationship between Krishna and His internal potency. Radharani represents the internal potency. The relationship is the source of everything in His internal potency. And, oh, by the way, there's marginal and external potency. So there's many potencies. But Radha is very special. That's the internal potency of the energetic source of everything. So that's pretty simple. And again, they may just be the arguing type, and they really don't want to know. They just want to argue, and so give them prasadam.
Good. Yes. Instead of satisfying our lower needs, does it make sense to try to be a sattva-guru made of goodness, motives, instead of trying to satisfy our lower needs? By lower, I mean physical, interpersonal, etc. I hesitate to use the word lower. It indicates something that's not, this that will take us away from Krishna consciousness. So I would say basic needs. Let's use the word basic needs instead of lower needs. Although you could use the word lower needs, but the implication is not so good. So the point is, I mentioned here is sattva guna. You can satisfy your lower needs, your basic needs, in sattva guna. I mean, let's say you need food. So what's the sattva guna or a shuddha sattva way of satisfying your need? Anyone here heard of prasadam? Prasadam? Okay, great. Or you may need to smell something nice. If you smell the incense and the flowers offered to the Supreme Personality of God, you know, survive and not Krishna, but however it is. So that's what Bhaktivinoda Thakur mentioned in the quote that I utilized yesterday, that our basic needs should be satisfied in the moment of goodness. So we have loving relationships with the devotees. And if you have very close relationships with people who are not Krishna conscious, then that's satsangachara, vaishnavachara. That may actually not be helpful to your Krishna consciousness. So seek moment of goodness ways to satisfy all the basic needs, and of course, what does do with the spiritual needs? Not only moment of goodness, you should have sought what needs. Does that sound good? So you're going to do recreation, don't play rugby. You know what rugby is? Play volleyball. That's a small piece. That's a joke. Okay.
Next. Srila Prabhupada purport, 5, 10, 2, quote, killing an animal simply places an impediment on the way of his completing his term of imprisonment in a certain body, unquote. How is this an impediment? As an animal can take birth again to complete the term. Whose question? Could you explain the question?
So, Prabhupada explains that the animal, let us say, has a term, like 2 years, for example, life. But somebody...
He can't talk with... He's got to move his hands. He can't just talk without into a microphone. He's got the style. Try it. Just hold it right in front of your mouth. It's really a challenge, isn't it? We're having fun.
Yeah.
He does it with disciples, too. He teases disciples. I've watched it. It's really cute. Are you dog? Come on. During the seminar in Chicago, you were teasing your disciple like anything. You were really... You're humiliating him and laughing, and he was laughing. And you said, we do this. This is our fun.
I actually, he paid the businesses and I stepped on top of it.
That was one of the, they, we had like 10 things. They have this regular exchange with each other. It's really lovely. If you're an outsider, you think this man is really sick. When he's just there. It's a loving exchange. So keep going.
So, Prabhupada is saying that each animal has a set lifetime.
Yes.
Like for 2 years, for example, and let us say somebody kills an animal in the middle of lifetime, like 1 year, for example.
Okay, you're interpreting the statement. Now, what's your question? I understood the.
Okay.
Your question is?
Question is, animal will take back again the same species.
Okay.
And then people have
supposing, so, I don't know, how long does a, I don't know, how long does a rabbit live? Or if there, let's say, an animal's lifespan might be X, and some life of that animal is taken for whatever the reason, hunting or cruelty or... Right? You're just talking with my hands. then they are killed. They're going to take birth again. They're going to have to go through it again from zero for their, whatever that duration is.
Not the duration?
They don't take birth again at 3 years old. They take birth again at zero. So you're interrupting their lifespan. They have to do it again. That's, I think that's what your question is. Isn't it?
Almost,
okay.
So let's say the animal rabbit lifetime is 5 years.
Whatever, yeah.
So 2 years, someone interrupted after 2 years. After 2 years.
So someone kills the rabbit after 2 years. Then?
That is, the rabbit takes birth again. And it has to go through from childhood.
Yeah, yes, it has to go through. He has to do the.
Only 3 more years?
No.
5 years.
Five. Oh. Okay, next question. Comedy hour. This is good.
Alright. Okay, here's an interesting one. Maharaj, please speak something about how to cultivate or address the need for autonomy in relationship with the spiritual master who is our authority without feeling guilty or slackening in submission. Well, the way to do that is to inquire seriously and give feedback to the spiritual master. That's basically to explain to the spiritual master that honestly, when you said that, I felt that because I have this particular need, these are the promises of communication without being defiant towards the spiritual master.
Arjuna does it right in Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah.
There's the perfect example.
Yeah, it says in Krishna many times, it says, you know, you're confusing me by your words. You know, first you tell me, you know, the enunciation is good, and then you tell me you engage in some sort of activity. And so there's this back and forth conversation that's very good. So that's how we should be with our spiritual master. Back and forth. Not too many times. It's driving crazy. But basically, when you heal your mind, you are inspired by that instruction. I have some problems in my life. I'm in debt, so I have to work and pay off the debt. Would you be willing to wait until I pay off my debt until we send you to China?
Siberia first. Okay, here's a real interesting one. Could you ensure, how could we ensure to have good thoughts always? Life would be boring if we had good thoughts always. But Vaikuntha. And Vaikuntha means your thoughts are always good thoughts. No anxiety, Vaikuntha. And the spiritual Krishna Loka is like that also. But even when it looks like the material kind of a bad thought, it's a good thought. Huh? That's double talk. Prabhupada explains this in Nectar of Devotion. When there's a sad, apparently sad thought, like, you know, the example is the feelings of separation from Lord Ramachandra. That's the example given in Nectar Devotion. It looks like sadness and sorrow, but it's an ecstasy. It's a transcendental increase. These children are babbling too much. Can somebody help them to go somewhere and babble elsewhere? Gently, of course. Don't push them out the window. Excuse me. A little comedy. Okay. Even an apparently bad thought is increasing the love for the personality of Godhead by feelings of separation, etc., etc. So the appearance of something that's not positive is positive. It's an ecstasy. It's a science. Oh. Okay.
Okay. Another one. When someone is angry, and I say, are you feeling angry because you have a need for da-da-da? They get more angry. Or sometimes someone will say, don't you CC with me? Two parts to that question, actually. You're diagnosing someone when you say they're angry. They may not be angry. They may be frustrated. They may be anxiety. There may be a number of things or feelings that they are having that you're not aware of. So you have to be careful about guessing someone's, especially these particular strong emotions. Like if someone is feeling sad, sometimes you can guess that one. But with any strong emotion that appears to be a negative emotion, especially if you're observing they're speaking at 120 decibels. That's an observation. You can't say, They're speaking loudly. That's not an observation. So you pick out your phone with the decibel data.
Come on.
120 decibels. 119.1. And you say, you don't want to do that. Even if they are angry, the way you use empathic communication with any of those really strong emotions that are shocking you, you have to be, you're quiet. And you reflect internally what you feel that they're feeling and what you feel that they're needing.
So you state your perception and ask for verification about your perception? Is that what you're saying?
You wouldn't do it. No, you do it internally. You wouldn't even speak about it. You would just reflect it with your body language.
So you don't say anything. You're just like...
No, not for anything. No, not...
That's body language.
I know, not that much.
Okay, well... Can you role play what the body language means when someone is raising their voice and you don't say, are you angry? Or, are you angry?
First you would do what I would do in certain settings if they're threatening some violence some way. But if they're just laughing about, I would do some internal easing, which means I'm seeing them flailing about, I have a need to either understand, I have a need for peace. Mm. And once I come in touch with my own needs, I can peacefully try to understand what their need is without speaking it.
And so what would you do besides trying to understand?
I would be empathic with them, not shocked.
So you would say what?
I wouldn't say anything.
You wouldn't say anything?
No.
Just
so
let
them. If you say something... That makes them, if they are angry, it'll make them angrier.
Really?
Yeah.
What if you don't say anything? That may make them angrier too. I've had that experience.
Yeah, that may happen. So you use your discretion, but it wouldn't be argued and you wouldn't use the EC language. One of the things that frustrates a lot of the people who are learning empathic communication and nonviolent communication is that they start talking in this language all the time. I was speaking to a friend, President Bihari, who went to mediation school, and he said it drove him crazy when he met some of the followers of Marshall Rosenberg. Because practically every conversation was, are you feeling? Do you have a baby? And it just drives people crazy. So you think like that. What is the person feeling? What is their need? And you may speak, or you may not speak, depending upon the situation. But generally, in a situation where someone is exhibiting that sort of intense emotion, I will not say anything. Or I may say, can I help in some way? But I won't say, are you angry? Because that's going to make you angry. Now, sometimes you may say something to diffuse the situation, like, can I do something? But it depends on the situation. It's a question of a judgment call. It's a judgment call. Generally, I do not say anything in a situation like that, because it will further inflame the person. Especially if you try to guess at their feelings or needs, but speaking guess, then we'll further define the relationship.
How to become courageous in asking forgiveness to another devotee to atone for an offense. How to become courageous in asking forgiveness to another devotee to atone for an offense. Well, one thought on this is pause meaning, for me that means go into the mode of goodness place or space and contemplate this, you know, who you are, who they are, the implication of whatever it is that you have done and how they must be feeling and how Krishna is feeling. And, you know, when you're coming from a place of between you and this person with Krishna at the center, you want that Krishna is pleased. This is me speaking, it's not the easy jargon, but you want Krishna to be pleased and you'd like this relationship to be unobstructed. And so, with those thoughts in mind, you can be courageous if you know if Krishna is going to help you. That's my thought on this.
Right? Hare Krishna. Communication between wife and husband is usually authoritative.
This is the husband speaking.
Which I think was due to a misconception that they owned each other. How to go beyond this misconception? I'm not going to ask you who wrote this. Attend our seminar. And maybe do some couples workshops apart from that, to talk to each other about each other's needs. And also another way to do that is facilitated role play. In other words, you switch the roles. The husband takes on the role of the wife takes on the role of the husband, and it should be done with a facilitator there, someone who knows what they're doing. And then they act as they would in their respective roles. And then each partner will say how they felt as the other person acted as them, and what was the need fulfilled or not fulfilled. So this is the start of empathy. For example, let's say the husband takes on the role of wife, the wife takes on the role of the husband, and the wife, acting as the husband, says, make my dinner. You know, roll those cookies. And they have to be perfectly wrapped. And the husband, through the wife, will be feeling anxiety, stress, because she has a need for understanding or love. And so they will each express each other's needs, and this will lead to further understanding. This will take some time to work that out. Okay?
While performing service with devotees, when we are in a role where we have to communicate the roles and responsibilities of the service to those other devotees, especially when they're older in age to us, what should be our mood? And how to communicate to them without offending them? And also get the service going properly. This is a nice question. It's a culture question. And it's, of course, it's person specific, but a cultured person will be tolerant in any case. But if we just, if the mood is, because that's the question, is respect. And I'm the younger person, you're the older person. By nature, I respect you, and I have a service to carry out. Here's the picture of how we would like to carry out this service. Are you comfortable with that? How do you like that? And, you know, so some respectful submission, but at the same time, you have a task to see that something gets carried out. So you're taking the role and responsibility of seeing that something gets carried out while simultaneously being respectful of an elder person. And when that dynamic is observed, that's fine. The older person thinks, wow, this is a refined, cultured young person. I'm happy to play my part. And he may make some, the elder person may make some suggestion and say, did you consider this and what about that? And okay, now I understand. Okay, let's go. So there's some dialogue, very similar to what Veerkrishnamurti was saying in response to another question, getting feedback, and then off we go. We're a team. We're working together. Older, younger, doesn't matter. We're working together to please Krishna.
Okay. This one I could have written. This question, I didn't like this so no further. Maharaj mentioned about the importance of listening when someone is speaking. My observation is that people who speak continuously without much gas are an advantage, as they are able to express their feelings, needs, without being interrupted. However, I speak slowly and I'm interrupted often, thus fail to express my feelings and needs. Sounds like my experience with some GBC interviews. So, what I would do is approach that person, not as a meat person, in particular.
We love GBC meetings. Everyone should have the experience. At least, you know, 5 minutes of it.
See, Maharaj is liberated now. He's a liberated soul. And I'm so conditioned to having to go to the GBC meeting.
Okay, let's go.
So what I would do in this particular case, which I haven't done, unfortunately, is that I would take the person when they're peaceful, after they've eaten prasadam, and explain my feelings and needs and explain what I see. So if I haven't done that, I have to admit it. Usually I just explode. And you've seen me do that at the meeting. I said, I would say, I can't get a word in edgewise. You're always speaking and always contradicting everything I'm saying. And then I just shut up and don't say anything for the rest of the meeting. You see
that? Yeah, I've seen that. The second part, at least.
Yeah. Yeah, there's so much of the rest of the meeting. I haven't seen those clothes. I have. So, anyway, so not with Maharaj, he's kind, gentle, perfect.
Liberated soul.
But it has to be others. So, what I should do is, aside, ask the person, can I have a meeting with you at a particular time in a peaceful situation, and explain my own feelings and needs, and say, I'm not demanding anything of you, but this is.
Okay, here's a funny one. The other day I had a problem sleeping. I tried all sorts of tossing and turning and still could not sleep, so I started chanting and I was soon fast asleep. My question is, is that okay? To start chanting in bed or have it committed an offense? Well, don't make it a regular habit, Prabhu. Well, I would, you know, if it's on an occasion like this and something happens when you start chanting like you fall asleep, that's, you know, but there are other techniques. And a principle that I read it because I was curious about it. You use something that's really like, you know, counting sheep. You know that one? You heard that one?
Mm-hmm.
It's just like repetitive, repetitive, and repetitive, and the neurotransmitters kind of get quieter, and you know, it takes your mind away from whatever that thing is that was irritating it that we were. It goes over some other place that's just repetitive and repetitive, and it's kind of like a mental sedative. and you, the whole nervous system quiets down, you can rest. So, you know, it's not an offense, but don't do that on a regular basis. Go ahead.
Yeah, actually, just to answer that question, what Mara said about repetitive stuff, what I do is I count down from 100.
Oh, really?
And by the time I've reached about 60, I've lost it.
Okay.
You know, counting sheep is hard to visualize sheep.
And then especially when they have to jump over a fence.
You know, usually when I get to about 70, then I start skipping. You know, 70, 64, then I get slammed. It works every time I do it. So, Mara, thank you for the precious insights as to how to recognize one's needs. After recognizing the need, how to stay connected to the need. You may have a strategy like writing it down or reminding yourself, you know, that's the need, that's why I'm feeling this. It's just a question of remembering that. And when you do remember it, the interesting thing is that you may not need to do anything about it. Just by recognizing the need. I'll give you an example. It's like anger. One's angry because one has a need for food. That happens sometimes. That's why I don't talk to people before they eat. So, if you recognize that, I mean, ultimately you get some food, but you recognize you're taking responsibility for it. I find that the anger gets diffused at that particular time. Many cases, you don't have to do anything as soon as you understand and be connected to the feeling. Okay?
I want to deepen my relationship with my spiritual master. I'm currently blocked by doubts that prevent me from going deeper in relationships. In general, I want to express my doubts, but I have a fear of being rejected if I express something that is personal. I feel stuck. And I want to come out of this stage. I'm going to go back and watch this video again, but I'll invite all of you, certainly this person, whoever wrote this, TED Talk Vulnerability. And the lady that's the speaker is... She characterizes herself as a storyteller and a statistics analysis person. You know, kind of like that side and then the other side. And the conclusion that the course of developing her talk is connectivity. She uses the term. In fact, maybe it's just a modern word, but connectivity in relationships. And some people have it, some people don't have it. What makes the difference? Those people that have it and that are well-balanced, they're able to enter into a space that they're making themselves vulnerable, which means they don't know what the outcome is going to be, because we don't know what the outcome is going to be anyway. But they're willing to enter into that space because they have a sense of self-worth and self, you know, there's something inside, not the storeroom is empty. They're not just showy on the outside, they have something on the inside, and they're able to have relationships because that's something that can't be taken from them. But so how to have this is similar to this other question about courage, but it's when you express yourself to anybody. You know, today it's a nice sunny day. And who knows, maybe tomorrow it's rainy. Or I know somebody that's contemplating who is a good person to become married to. And then, you know, they want to, as best as they can, make sure it's a person who is compatible to a bhakti lifestyle. They don't have to be already. So, who knows what the future is going to hold? Someone that could be a bhakti compatible today is tomorrow something else. Or you don't. The future is uncertain. But if the self worth is there, the intrinsic self worth is there, you can enter into a dialogue and not have to worry about, is it going to be a good outcome or a bad outcome? You're entering into a meaningful relationship, and then it unfolds as it unfolds. You're thoughtful about the persons with whom you enter into such meaningful relationships, or in this particular case, it's not clear whether the person is saying they want to deepen their relationship with spiritual master, but they're feeling disconnected with their spiritual master, or they're wanting to connect more with relationships, plural, and they're not sure about exposing that weakness that they have to their spiritual master. This is not, but it really doesn't so much matter A or B. It's the person who you look to as spiritual master is a person who you have faith in. Not that that person must be a 100% perfect individual, but I have faith in this person. I can reveal my heart to this person and not be judged or manipulated or something. But this is a person who I trust, and they're trustworthy, and I'll receive some wisdom from this person. That's the person who you take such questions to. Now, the fear that I might be judged, then I'll not have any relationships with anybody, because who knows, it's going to judge me, so I'll just be a private person and then feel lonely. I wish I had relationships. So some persons are more private, some persons are more social. Some persons are more trusting, and some persons are less trusting and more cautious. That's okay, we're different. Those core relationships should be ones that you have considered very carefully. Here is a trustworthy person or persons, and I'm investing my trust in them. And those that are trusted in that way have to be very trustworthy, capable of handling the trust that's invested in them. Even we're less than perfect beings, and we may make mistakes, but it's a very important. Relationships are very important to have and to be trustworthy in those relationships. That's really big for each of us. Go ahead.
Okay. So here is a short question. Based on the shloka, Krishna says that whenever Dharma declines, I will come personally and set it up. So the question is, Krishna came and taught us lessons to follow the practice. However, when he went, Kali Yuga started. So where is Dharma? Actually, we'll let all of you answer that. So what does the Bhagavatam say? What's the quote from the Bhagavatam? Krishna? So, what is the answer to the question? Bhagavatam! Bhagavatam and this Krishna consciousness movement and the holy names. And Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavatam. So, Krishna's presence in the Bhagavatam. That's the book Bhagavatam. And also, Krishna's present in the person Bhagavatam. So when we're talking about establishing religious principles, Krishna can accomplish that either by personally coming down or empowering someone or empowering the Bhagavatam, which the Bhagavatam is always empowered, to establish religious principles. Krishna said, Prabhupada mentions also that This process of Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara-Yidara Krishna's devotees. And the real reason that Krishna comes down, his personal reason for coming down, is to engage in his pastimes to attract the living entities. So they all speculate upon the nature of the Absolute, and so they will become attracted to the higher spiritual reality.
Okay. Here's two papers that's very close, almost the same question. For those of you that weren't in the class, I spoke something saying that I have this little phrase, many people join the Hare Krishna movement with their mind. And that it takes a while to get beyond just the mind, because to a deeper position than just the mind. So what advice could you give for the devotees who join ISKCON by their mind for progress in devotional service? Well, either it can be done consciously, willfully, and, you know, step by step, or it can be circumstances help you. That is, consciously, Krishna says there are four types of pious people that render devotional service. I want, I want, I want, or I want. There's different wants, but I'm expecting something from Krishna. And we, to sustain enthusiasm in Krishna consciousness, we have to go beyond the I want and hit the reset button and go like this person is asking. It's a self-reflection question. What's the real purpose of devotional service? It's not just getting what I want. It's giving Krishna service with love. So that takes some time. It's innate. We've discussed this, and it needs to be considered carefully. So the considering carefully is based upon our hearing and chanting process. So do your hearing and chanting with attention to understand Rupa Goswami and Lord Chaitanya and our great acharyas and that gift that they want to give us. Hear with that eagerness. And then we can go beyond the joining the Hare Krishna movement with the mind. We can go to a deeper position from the heart, as we saw in this presentation. That the mind can go here, mind can go and does go here and there. It's chanchala. So whether it's the mind is over here or the mind is over there, there's only one thing. That the foundation of my participation in Krishna consciousness is not the configuration of what's out there and how my mind is reading it. It's who I am. This fundamental, I am meant for Krishna's pleasure. And you operate from that position. So that the hearing and chanting done in a qualitative way, and the gradual purification that comes by the process of devotional service, which includes experiencing the duality that goes through the mind and not identifying with it, stepping back from it, and going deeper. Going deeper into the bhakti. So directing the mind towards pleasing Krishna. Gradually coming to that position. From that deeper place. Hare Krishna.
Okay. Hare Krishna. What should we do in an abusive relationship? Call 911.
You bet.
Yeah, it depends on what you mean by an abusive relationship. If something is physically abusive, yes, consult the legal authorities. Mm-hmm. But don't remain in that situation. Mm. But if something is not At that extent, it's verbally abusive, then you need counseling. There's nothing wrong with counseling. You're seeing, let's say, a marriage counselor or somebody who's trained with, if it's a marriage relationship or a friendship relationship, someone who is trained in counseling that can help you understand, or help the person understand, who is acting in such a way to threaten your needs, your need for safety, your need for emotional safety, or they're abusing you by not giving you, let's say, food, or something like that. Mm. That's abusive, actually.
Mm.
To punish someone, or to try to change their behavior, shape their behavior, by withdrawing love of food, that's an abusive relationship. You need to identify that and seek help.
Okay. How do we cultivate making decisions without emotions and sentiments? Well, we don't make decisions without emotions or sentiments. They have to be guided. You don't need to anesthetize your mind, but you need to direct the mind with intelligence and make decisions in that manner, and make the mind clean by the hearing and chanting process.
While we are becoming more aware of another person's needs and working on strategies to fulfill those needs, how do we ensure that we are not pushing the individuals into their comfort zones to contributing towards the evolution of needs increasing of those particular needs? First of all, don't work on strategies to fulfill that person's needs. That's the person's responsibility. You can help the person understand about the implications of each particular strategy. That is called facilitation. A good counselor does not solve or attempt to solve someone's problems. You help the person understand their needs, understand their feelings, understand their issues, and come up with practical solutions to those things. But don't impose on the person. If you impose on the person first, well, probably won't accept it. Secondly, it's not going to solve the person's needs. The person has to own the strategy. If you don't own the strategy, you won't be enthusiastic about it.
Hmm. Okay. Here's a mothering question from a sannyasi. No, I'm from sannyasi is supposed to answer a mothering question. How to identify core belief systems that render me angry, etc., in situations. So here's the example. I was getting angry when my son takes long showers. My need was, I get a large water bill and I need to control water wastage. But I was told I was in a belief system that my son is rendering me a failure. Now, so, the belief system that the son is rendering me a failure, I don't really understand that because I don't know if that's a belief system. So maybe it's the language that's confusing me, but nothing wrong with being concerned about wasting water. It's probably less important than the size of the water bill than just being wasteful. So if there's a value that you hold, a value system that you shouldn't be wasteful of Krishna's energy, then how do you convey that? That isn't conveyed by anger. You know, that's not very ineffective. So it's education. Example in education. we value Krishna's energy and we're careful in using Krishna's energy. That's a value that I hold. How about you? Do you feel that's an important value? And once you understand, once the value is understood, then the application of the principle becomes, you know, it may take some coaxing and repeating and gently helping the person to understand, the younger person, the child, the son. But anger isn't going to do anything. Anger is going to tell the son, shh, this lady's out to lunch. I don't really need to listen to this angry person. I'm going to listen to my mind. And I'm going to rebel. I may get a behavior when she's around. When she's not around, I'm going to do what I want. So, it doesn't... The belief system is not... Her anger is being triggered by the belief system. She's a failure if her son doesn't do what she asks. It's something else. Go ahead.
Okay. Such a big part of communication is nonverbal. For instance, if someone who is speaking with hands flailing and being snappy and irate and had a contentious attitude, etc., etc., well, they're definitely communicating something. I don't really find... Oh, here. How to make observation... Oh, sorry. A body language and tone of decibel level when practicing DC. It's easier to make observation about the words spoken. Oh, that is a good part. It's such a big part of communication. So, you could say someone is flailing their hands. Being snappy is actually a judgment. You could say what they're saying. And it's pretty... you can do an observation about hands, you can do an observation about temperature, you can do an observation about decibel level, you can do an observation about any of those things. Or at least an observation is I perceive something. That's an observation. And then, when you make that observation, then you have to respond in an appropriate way. I don't understand what the difficulty is in making an observation about body language. You know, flailing the hands, frowning. That's body language. You're frowning, all those things like that. So I don't find it difficult. And then you guess in your own mind what your particular feeling and emotion is, and you try to reflect it non-verbally.
Can you give an example?
Okay. Example, okay, what do you do with drama?
We do drama. Not with you. It's called life. Life is a drama.
Who wants to be the person flailing and, you know, all like that? Is there a volunteer?
This little girl, she's into it. She's...
No one wants to volunteer.
But just say...
I have to have someone to stimulate me to do that. So when do you volunteer? Where's is Nanda Sutra here?
He just left. We are volunteer.
Oh, volunteer, okay. So you're just like angry and say something angry.
He doesn't need a microphone.
You can do it, you can be loud. You don't need a microphone. Okay.
This is the role play.
This is the role play. Okay. Say something.
I watched all the parts, and all of them are bad. And there are no volunteers. How do I do this?
That main thing, he's trying to communicate something. I'm hearing him. He has a need for cooperation.
Yeah.
He has a need for cooperation. And then later on,
says, what? This guy's listening to me. I said, would you like more people to cooperate with you?
Yes.
Okay.
Simple.
Acknowledge the need.
Acknowledge the need, but I don't get into the feeling.
Okay, got it.
I wouldn't say, are you angry? But he has to cool down a little first.
Okay, got it.
I have to hear him first and acknowledge the need and perhaps say, you know, we need more people to help you. And if it's not the need, he'll correct me at that particular point, but he has to quiet down first.
Okay, got it.
If he doesn't quiet down, it's not going to work.
It's going to bounce.
It's like if I come up immediately and he's going like that and said, you need more people to help you? Yeah, no one helps me.
It's 1 o'clock.
Okay.
And the last one is another funny one. Or no, it's a story. On Saturday, you mentioned that there was a story behind the sliding doors of Gitanagari Temple. Could you please explain what that is? So, summer of 1971, my memory serves me right. There was a move from 439 Henry Street, Brooklyn, to a 12-story building in Manhattan, 7th Avenue. And the person who found it was previously owned by Catholic Charities, and they had something of a fire sale, and it was purchased at a reduced rate, and so the temple was purchased with a big mortgage, and there were three altars. And so Radha Govinda were in the central altar, Jagannath Baladev Subhadra on the right altar, Gornatai on the left altar. So they started with curtains like this, but then Tosan Krishna designed, and Jivadar, another Prabhupada disciple from Trinidad, made these doors. It took like months, and they're really heavy, and they were also sliding like this. But, you know, it was a major, major project. It was all done by hand, you know, devotee craftsmanship. And when that building was sold, one set of the doors came here. And the Vyasasan, similarly, came here. If you look carefully at the photographs of Prabhupada in the Brooklyn Temple, there was this lotus-shaped Vyasasan. And then when the lotus-shaped Vyasasan was replaced, when we moved to 55th Street, the lotus-shaped Vyasasan came here because this property was once upon a time the New York farm. There was some history that I described to some people. There was a period of history when Srila Prabhupada said that temples that are well developed in the urban area, they should find a rural property and develop simple living, high thinking. Was really speaking about that a lot. They should have some rural community, a farm community or a simple living, high thinking community. And so the devotees got all fired up, and their GBC had us all out, you know, selling books and things to raise some money to buy a farm, and this was the farm. They looked around, the person that was looking was really fussy, and he never found anything that was quality agricultural land that he found out here in Mid-Pennsylvania. And so we ended up in Mid-Pennsylvania. And that which was the New York farm, eventually it was too far away. And that's part of the difficulty for Gitanagari. It doesn't have that urban connection. It's too far away from New York. So now it's it is what it is. You know, the milk, the organic produce and things. So it's a difficulty. But that's the history behind the doors. And, you know, they're going to last a long time. They're very, very heavy. All hardwood, nicely decorated. And that's the history behind the doors. And it's 5 minutes after 1 o'clock. Thank you all for coming. Shri Shri Radha Damodar Ki Gaur Pimanandi.
Anyone who hasn't gotten one of the books, who wants one of the books, I have some here. Mm-hmm.